This episode is brought to you by Charcoal Book Club, the world's first photo book of the month club. Each month, Charcoal sends you a new book that's been selected by one of their excellent curators. I'm always looking to discover new work, and it's a real treat getting a book in the mail every month you may not have picked up by yourself. Join the club at charcoalbookclub.com, and they'll give you any book of your choice from their shop free when you use the code MAGICHOUR. That's charcoalbookclub.com, and use the code MAGICHOUR to claim your free book.
Self-conscious stage fright, or this concern about the appearance of the one who's making it. Oh, this is a fine one. I never saw that before. Oh, that's beautiful. Bones are, they're so different. They show such a, they're not like anybody else.
You know, I was blown up. I was burned real badly in the house. Did you know that? The gasoline stove exploded, and my hands are, you can still see, guys. The whole skin was blown off my hands and my face, too. When I got better, I changed it.
I'm Jordan Weitzman, and you're listening to Magic Hour. We've got a pretty special show for you today. A conversation that happened 46 years ago. In 1972, a 30-year-old Danny Lyon got in a plane and flew to Chicago with a Nagra tape recorder to go interview Hugh Edwards. Edwards rarely gave interviews, and Lyon wanted to get both his life story and a sense of his character on tape. Hugh Edwards was one of the most influential curators in photography of the 20th century that you may never have heard of. Edwards started working at the Art Institute of Chicago in 1927. From 1959 to 1970, he was associate curator of prints and drawings, and in that role, he was in charge of the museum's photography department. He gave Robert Frank, Dwayne Michaels, and Danny Lyon their first solo shows, and was an early champion of many young photographers who'd go on to become some of our greats. Ing Morath, Bruce Davidson, Maria Cassindas. At the time, if you were a serious photographer, there were really only two shows in town, MoMA in New York and the Art Institute in Chicago. John Sarkowski reigned supreme at the Museum of Modern Art, and largely due to his outgoing, gregarious personality, has become etched in stone as the curator in photography from that era. But then there was Edwards, a shy man who didn't write much and disliked publicity. They conducted the interview at Edwards' Hyde Park apartment over 4 days. The following conversation is an edited version of that tape. Edwards was smoking Parliament cigarettes and his crutches were by his side on the couch. In the full recording, they talk over the music playing full blast for about 10 minutes, until Edwards gets a little philosophical.
That last novel of his, well, stop this now. One time there was a girl who, when I was playing the Bacchanini Variations, the Brahms, and somebody knocked on the door, and I went, and she said, I like that music very much. It's Brahms, isn't it? But she said, it's driving me mad. She said, I'll have to jump out of the window if you don't stop. So what could you do? And then she came again, and the second time I told her, I said, well, it'll be just as painful for me to stop it as it is for you to have to hear it. So then she went away.
She never came back?
No, she moved. She moved, I think she was in there first, and then she moved farther back. And she said, I can hear that all the way to the back. And I said, well, a stranger were the only person who was disturbed by it. You know. Well, it is awful to have to listen to other people's music. Or other people's anything. Is that running?
The tape recorder?
Yes. It's so, I don't know, even when they're silent, they don't feel like that. It doesn't feel like that it's even in here.
How did you get interested in photography? Were you always interested in it? I mean, as a boy?
Well, photographs were the first pictures I ever saw. I mean, I certainly didn't come to know pictures through painting and drawing. The only kind of painting I knew was China painting, which my aunt taught in the town. Everybody, every lady took China painting, you know. The first photographs that I liked very much, I'm always glad that I never thought of them as photographs or anything, but what they represented. And but the first ones was a set of the old Review of Review's photographic history of the Civil War, you know, in 10 volumes, these blue cloth things.
Where'd you see them? I mean, was that
in the
library?
Library in Paducah. In Paducah.
Did that woman show them to you, or
no,
did you just
I found
find
them myself?
Yourself?
Because the stacks were right behind the charging desk, and you were allowed to go back there, and they were all mixed up. And so, one summer I gave myself the job of straightening up those stacks, and it was the finest small library collection I've ever known. And. Brownie camera, of course, came into everybody's lives, and I made a lot of pictures. Then, of course, you had to take them to be developed, and always in every town there was some dedicated person who was trying to make an art out of photography, and it was something certainly above the China painting art at the time. And you made pictures just as sort of a part of your life. I mean, it was just like going to the movies in those days. I mean, people didn't go to the movies, and now when people go to see moving pictures, they go in the same way they used to go to hear string quartet concerts and lectures and that kind of thing. It's become such a cultural obligation to go to a moving picture. And of course, when things get to this stage, they may be better technically, and they may be conceived as a whole better, but certainly the great vitality is lost. But nowadays there's all that trying to make snapshots, you know, people who attend schools and classes in photography and that sort of thing, trying to make the picture look like a snapshot. Well, this is one of the deadest forms of sophistication, because nobody who gets to that stage could ever make a snapshot. I mean, they forget that.
Yeah, I know. I can't. I couldn't.
You often tell them that every photograph is fundamentally a snapshot. I mean, and the word snapshot, of course, is almost as old as the word photography. I think it was Sir John Herschel who coined that, along with the rest.
Yeah, what does it mean? I mean, what was that, just like a photograph taken very quickly or something?
Yes. It snaps and it's shot.
I know when I like the photographs that tattoo artists made, which were all Polaroids, you know. And I would like to publish them. They're fantastic photographs. But I couldn't make one of those things if my life depended on it. I mean, even if I really tried to, you know.
Polaroids?
Well, he used to just take these vertical color Polaroid pictures of these tattooed girls, you know, and I'm trying to.
Oh, they are still in existence.
Oh, yeah. Who came to Chicago? Did you come to Chicago first before
I came here to study music. I did not. I was always very fond, of course, naturally, of music, but and my grandmother used to take in boarders, and we got theatrical boarders who would come to the theater to play in the stock company every winter. And in this way, I got great passion for the theater. I went a great deal because we had a theater in our town. And being on the way to Louisville, of course, we had all kinds of great actors and people came, at least for one night, like the Barrymores, Richard Mansfield even, and all this kind of people, and they came to my uncle's ice cream parlor after the show, and they were sort of looked at politely by everybody, and this gave me such a great passion for the theater. And then I went to the moving pictures every day. I was given a nickel to go to the moving pictures every afternoon. The program was only about 45 minutes at the longest.
They changed every day?
And they changed, I think they changed every day, yes. I saw all those old early Griffith things, and many things, like the famous Gaviria, for which D'Annunzio had written a scenario, and you just saw everything. And of course they were silent. It didn't make any difference what country they came from. They certainly didn't have to put titles on them, which nowadays, you've only half seen a foreign motion picture that you see with titles.
Did you come
the
up
the whole
then?
Movement of the thing, of course, is disturbed by these things.
You came up after then you finished with high school? Is that when you came to?
Well, I finished in high school. I was working in the public library for this time, and I stayed there for 6 years before I came away, I think. Because I was working there when I was in school.
But when I met you, though, photography was a very special thing to you. I mean, you really gave me that feeling.
Somehow to me it always seemed to be the way to make pictures.
Yeah, but I mean, when I met you in 1962 or 1961, whenever that was, you know, you filled me with the feeling that photography was really this very great thing, you know, because you. I directed all my ambitions to it, and I was a very ambitious person.
Yes, and I think you have always made photographs as I think they should be made. But, I don't...
But you made me feel it was a very great thing. I mean, it was something... It was the first thing that I encountered that... Maybe it was the first thing I encountered that I could do right, you know, but it became worthy of really a lot of work.
It's become so intellectually
captured
now, and it's so mixed up. It's still a great thing, and it's probably greater even than it ever was, because, well, like all great things, examples of them are certainly very rare, and they're never going to be, we can't have photographers by the carload or more than we could have painters. Of course, we live in an age of materialistic production, and we want an overproduction of everything. If it doesn't overproduce, why, the thing isn't functioning or something of this kind.
I don't think, most people don't realize that, I mean.
But now they
someone asked me what contemporary photographers I like. I mean, I couldn't think of a single one.
Yes, well, I think
myself.
That the great the virtue of photography is that its great examples can be completely anonymous. And I don't mean the news photograph either, because the news photograph is certainly something very different. That's a special thing that without the text and the situation and the time, the contemporaneity and so forth, it cannot be a great picture on its own. You take the great news photographs of the past. Now, the photographs of the Civil War certainly were not what we think of as news photographs. They were not instantaneous capturings of any detail of an event or anything. They were usually made after the event. And they were carefully composed and carefully thought out. Roger Fenton's Crimean War photographs, of course, were made before the battle, but they somehow, you feel that the whole event is approaching in them, I think, whereas the American Civil War photographs are classic, almost marbleized renditions or tributes to an event. the best thing we come to capturing an actual event, I think, is in sport photography. And why we have all this clamor about photography as an art and wanting to create a dictatorship and dictate rules what makes the photograph. It's almost just getting right back to the camera club ethics. But anything can be a good thing, even a camera club photograph.
For all that they make of photography now, I mean, well, it's beginning to become an art. They sell the prints for more and everything. But there's no one who seems able to say anything about them that makes any sense at all, you know. I guess that's because, they never talk about they're not capable of really talking about what the photograph is of, you know.
It doesn't seem to concern most of them. Well, of course, young people are so fascinated by the thing as a technique. I mean, anything, any technique or what we call a technological method of any kind fascinates people because they feel they can master it. People, it's quite different than the idea that people want to be the victims of techniques or that they will be, but the charm of techniques is that people feel that they can master them. And any technique is just a complicated way of doing something very simple and doing it well. But young people, of course, are always fascinated by the technique, first by the cameras themselves, by the attributes of the whole thing. And they want... this is only natural. And that's, certainly technique generally in the last 15 years has improved. So it used to be that a certain kind of picture that was taken, say, of, what we call casual pictures, perhaps, you didn't consider the technique or you didn't discount the thing because of the technique or the excellence of it, because it was such a miracle that that thing was made. But I think in the last 20 years or so, it's just like the technique in music and in musical performance has improved so. There was nothing like it in the past. Nobody even stuck to the notes.
Were you doing the shows in night? When you show Frank, you were doing photography shows at the Art Institute?
Oh, yes.
When did Pollock stop?
Was the director of publicity there, just as I was the associate curator of prints and drawings. And this job, Mr. Rich, the former director, was very interested in motion pictures and photography way back, I think, before most museums began considering it as part of their programs. But anyhow, people were becoming conscious of photographers like Margaret Burke White and then later Cartier-Bresson and all these people. And they weren't bothering so much about it as an art form, as they use that awful expression now, and which means they're trying to reduce it to the terminology of another art, which it... is very far from. Of course, the only art is an art which does something which no other art can do, like the motion picture, for instance. It is an art, of course. I think most people admit that. Yet they still quibble about photography, and they look at photography and think of it in the terminology of other arts. Well, of course, I don't care whether it's an art or not. So Peter Pollock started his exhibitions in 1951, and they continued until 1957 when he left, and they had a great effect. I mean, they made a lot of... the great point in having photography in a museum is to show it with other things so that people can realize what its differences and what its superiorities are, and also what its shortcomings are. Very few photographers ever talk about the limitations of photography. And they think they're extending its extending the medium by making it look like some other art. And pictorially, there's nothing it can't do. That's been known ever since it appeared.
I started to make films. I think then it affected my pictures because I wanted to put so much more into the pictures. I think that's maybe why they've changed now. I have this, I just want to put everything in the picture, you know. I mean, everything that's going on around and the weather and
the
everything.
The motion picture is the great extension of photography, and it took place naturally. No artist got busy and tried to do something that I'm going to do something that'll extend the photographic medium. This took place, and it was only natural to make the pictures, want to make the pictures move. Well, of course, that creates another kind of art, which has is really something entirely different than the still photograph, because the motion picture is a time art, like literature and music, and it takes a certain, it's a progression in time from one thing straight through another, and it has great advantages, so that I don't think it should ever come into conflict with photography. And the discovery of it that so many photographers made, and they all, a few years ago, they were all giving up photography, and of course it's too bad that the two things can't be thought of as two related but very different things. And the motion picture, of course, well, the trouble with most modern, whatever they call them, experimental films they did several years ago, is that they don't move. And the first requirement of a motion picture is that it move. I mean, it's a very difficult thing. It's related to musical composition. I mean, the symphony or sonata, all the parts must move, and the whole thing must move. And there's nothing more gratifying. Also, the enjoyment of the sequence of images. I don't mean the motion picture sequence as it is spoken of, but just the sequence of various pictures and their relationship, where we cannot see them as on a wall. It also gives one a great sense of what still photographs can be when they are arranged with a concern for sequence. And, of course, I think a great still photograph can suggest movement without any kind of panning or any of those things that they try to do it with. For instance, Robert Rieger, I think, because he does have such a fine sense of painting and the background of that sort of thing, which has... I think it was Pierre Boss, the French scenario writer, said that the whole problem of art is to suggest motion. And a painted portrait can do this just as well, in a way, as a motion picture. A good photograph always suggests some kind of life or some kind of motion. What goes before that instant in which it's caught, and what is going to follow?
It seems like some of these stills now. It seems like each picture is. It's almost like an entire movie or an entire little movie, you know.
Well, I mean, because it suggests a past and a future that is immediate. And that gets back to the Schopenhauer idea, of course, that the only reality is the present instant. And we as human beings, the only thing we can capture is with the camera. And that has many inhibitions too. The motion picture, of course, the disadvantage there is it's such an inaccessible thing. The still photograph's bad enough. But at least we can, there is a possibility of having something like that and being able to look at it again the way, but people don't like to look at anything again anymore. They don't like to hear anything again. Young people, you say, well, I want to play this record. Well, they say, oh, I've already heard it. And it's done for.
Do you have any idea why Walker Evans
became a photographer?
Became Walker Evans out of the blue? I mean, I'm sure it wasn't that way, but...
It's very strange. That whole thing didn't begin to develop until about 1959, this great enshrining of Walker Evans as some kind... It didn't. I remember when I went to Eastman House that first year we had exhibitions, and the... I worked there for a whole year without a vacation until Mr. Joachim came. And then, of course, when he came there, you see, he wanted me to do photographic shows. The idea was to give me another title, and then their idea, the budget was so small, and their idea was to have two shows a year. Well, when people heard all over the country, somehow it got out that the Art Institute was going to start photographic shows. Of course, Pollock shows have been very popular, and the Art Institute, I think, is the most beloved museum in the country, that is, by the average people. The main idea was to try and get people to see what the life around them was like, and that is why I like that kind of photography. And I remember the Robert Frank show. Well, we, of course, were the first ones, I'm proud to say, that ever had one. And that is a one-man thing. And it was very surprising how people would come all the way to the print room, and it was quite a distance. And thank you for having that exhibition. Whereas the photographic people here were horrified at many things about this thing. But I remember the days when they called the Walker Evans pictures just old snapshots. They're nothing but old snapshots. And... I guess that's because these things look like photographs in both cases. I like photographs. I mean, I like them better really than any other kind of picture. And I certainly like other kinds. But they seem to be the authentic, and I certainly like photographs that look like photographs more than any other kind of photograph. And the very fact that anybody can do it really should make everybody think it's something very special. And
Well, isn't that what you meant when you call it anonymous? I mean...
Well, I think one of the great wonders about photography is...
Anyone could be holding the camera and...
Yes, and of course that is what makes people degrade it so and say, oh, well, it's just an accident when the thing is good. Well, now we know that isn't true. I mean, there are certain people that have a certain consistency and a certain character, but also there are people who can take just ordinary pictures and suddenly will take what one feels is a great picture, or I do. But you see, the educated photographic connoisseur has built up an artificial kind of discrimination, and they won't admit that sort of thing. They'll just sort of chuckle about it, maybe. But they cannot see that all good things are related, no matter what caste they come from. That's what I think is so wonderful about the French, is that they do a Frenchman a good piece of meat can be just as poetic, just as wonderful as a Mozart quartet or anything like that.
I'd like to, you know, like everything now, I kept thinking, I don't know what I thought, but I know that I always thought of, my life would be end, or I'd be dead at 30 or something, but everything was in a rush, and then having a baby, I just feel the opposite now. It seems like there's an unlimited amount of time, you know, I mean.
Well, that's always the way you like to feel when it gets shorter.
Yeah. Well, maybe, but now I see all these things that I want to photograph. Like, I've never really photographed the South the way I could or the way I'd like to. I love it, so I love all of that,
yeah,
you know.
And, I think you do.
I'm a much better photographer now than I ever was in the time I was.
Yes,
down
of course.
There,
then you were influenced by outside ideas and things, Mark.
Well, I just wasn't as good. That's all. I mean, I look at my contact sheets and I just see how.
I wish you could read.
Well,
there is an English translation of that. These essays that Ionesco has written about writing and things. Oh, in the American edition, they don't print the best essay because it was added to a later French edition. But about this thing about ideologists being. You see, now, there were ideologies that influenced Walker Evans, but I don't think they influenced him as much as he says they did now. Or as he now
says.
You
kind of make up ideologies to have something to say or something, but I mean, I think you're right. I don't think you really know why.
You said out there at the university that you didn't want things to change, that you. Because you knew they would change, of course. I mean, this change is inevitable. But this frenzy about change, and this, which is nothing but destruction. And it's the great American disease. Stockfield talked about that this would be the thing that would be.
All these neighborhoods I photograph, I mean, if I'm trying to justify it or get money, I mean, they just disappear the next day. You know?
If the picture is good, it will outlive the ideology. I mean, there are many great things that have come out used ideologies, but if the thing is really good, as Ionesco says, the work of art will always endure longer than any ideology, which has nothing to do with it.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Of course, your things, I think, they do what a lot of great motion pictures do. I mean, a director like Chabrol, his things are certainly grounded in realism, but they're not what we call realistic. I mean, he doesn't change anything in that last one, Le Boucher, the last one to be shown here. You know, this has the appearance of perfect realism, but it also has a quality, a very poetic kind of beauty about it that you know if you had been there when that was made, it would not have looked like that. Now that's the same way with that. You have elevated that. You have remained true to what it is and true to its reality. But it's something more than realism, this thing.
I only mean these that are, I,
all
I,
these
I,
pictures
it's
of
all,
yours.
I could never
and these later, ones are bringing out a much, much broader and a much more distant kind of conjuring up of what can't be explained, or what they used to call the beautiful, than anything else you've done. You have never... one thing I always liked about your pictures were, I like beautiful people, and the pictures, the people in all your pictures are beautiful, no matter what condition they're in, or what they are, or what they have passed through. They're not pretty, certainly, but I mean, your people are always beautiful because you do have a respect for them and a realization of what they might be, too, that you get into that present person. That certainly shows that prison book.
Yeah, I know.
And that's what those people, who could not understand it, missed the whole thing. And of course, if they did not appreciate it, I don't envy them.
You use the term realism, or you use a realistic many years ago, but it always stuck in my mind. Certainly, it was a better idea than using the word.
Well, of course, now I don't feel there is such a thing as realism. Who was it? I think Schopenhauer said that there is no reality but the present instant, and that is something we can't realize.
Well, I've never tried to realize it,
something that is based in reality, and that you see, the French writers are the ones who have always used reality as the substance of all their art.
The French writers,
the French painters, French everything, because the whole essence of French culture, I suppose you have to call it, is economy. French literature is an art of economy. So that it means that the material that is used is the commonplace. Now we have hundreds of young photographers. Say, 15 years ago, we had everybody making photographs of rocks and grass and all these things. Well, there should be no criticism of this, because anything can be good. And there are certain masters of that. I mean, there's Stieglitz and there's Harry Callahan and people like this. But to imitate the masters is always a very suspicious thing. I mean, there's no reason why there shouldn't be influences, and influences should not be criticized. Because if we come to it, it's probably, where does originality exist? I mean, in anything. Gide said everything could be reduced to a few Greek stories. And so that this problem of realism, what I can't understand is why there has to be any kind of snobbery in anything. And yet most people today are not only social snobs, they're media snobs, cultural snobs, and everything else, because they're trying to create an identity out of things that are outside themselves. And of course there is the so-called realistic social photograph, and this is as bad as anything, because the French idea comes up again that it is not for the artist to express himself. First of all, he should, or to express his emotions, he should provoke an emotion in somebody else. And this is what I think all great things do. Self-expression is a very temporary sort of thing. And then people who purvey ideas in pictures, of course, are nothing any more than propagandists of one kind or another. Great picture is something that awakens something very, a different reaction in each person who looks at it. Because not everybody's going to look at any picture, be drawn to it. But all is using the photograph or using any form of expression as to purvey ideologies to others. Well, we all know, we've all lost faith in all ideologies, I think, now, except the very young who want to have adventures with them or something. The picture that creates an individual response is a great picture, no matter who made it. And anybody might make it. Of course, there are so many people who feel that everything in photography is an accident. Well, of course, anyone who cares for photography knows this is not true. The miracle of photography is that the very thing which makes it great is something that nobody can explain, which is true of any kind of art, or any kind of manifestation. Well, what I was saying about ideologies with photographs or with pictures or with anything, the ideology, as Ionesco has explained so well, is something that is foreign to the work itself. It's something that is on the outside. Now, when we look at the Civil War photographs, they were made to show the horrors of war, perhaps. They didn't do it very completely because people were too squeamish to look at it in a picture. That is, in a picture that they felt was absolutely true, because this was a photograph, and the photograph can never lie. Well, of course, we know that the photograph is very treacherous in its renditions of the truth. And it shows us that reality is a changing thing, almost like light. It never stays the same, nor does the truth. It's always something elusive. But ideologies are fixed systems of things. They're like philosophical systems. They're almost, in many ways, they are aesthetic creations in their own way, and they are not, that's why they never work in life. Because life really, the longer one lives, the more aimless it seems to be. And Rabelais was the one who was right, who believed in a philosophy of aimlessness.
When I...
The only reason for living is to be alive, according to Montaigne, who was a little later than Rabelais.
When I photograph it, I always photograph like the older neighborhoods, you know, in the United States, and it just seemed like now there are many less of those neighborhoods left than even 10 years ago. It seems to me that as I travel around the country, you know, modern America becomes...
Yes,
but it's like they rebuilt the whole country. Eventually, they'll have done it completely. Well, they'll do it completely, but...
Jacques Ellul says it, and I think this is quite likely, more than anything, nothing can ever become completely general. There's always something to interrupt. A few years ago, we were all... Well, quite a number of years ago, we were all worried about the effect the machine has on the human being. The human being is going to be just obliterated, going to be converted into a kind of shadow of the machine. And then it became the electronic era, and we know a few years ago how everybody was listening to McLuhan to Jacques Ellul, who was much more profound and wittier. And this was a great concern. Suddenly, we don't seem to hear much about that anymore. No ideology fits everything.
I can't photograph...
I mean, your photographs, I often wonder if you do know why you are taking them. Because I think you're impelled by some kind of feeling.
Well, I don't have
any... Of course, to use words like feelings and sentiments and so forth nowadays is strictly forbidden.
Well,
to have feelings is strictly forbidden.
I can't have any feelings in a modern area.
If you have any feeling, if you express any feeling in anything, you're called a sentimentalist. Now, what there is more wrong about a sentimentalist, of course, I'm not talking about the sentimentalist of the new religious calendars and this kind of thing, which use Rod McKeown and his poems and that sort of thing as their mottos, but that sort of thing. The motives of that, of course, are very bad because they're strictly commercial. I mean, nearly everything nowadays is done with the idea of making money. We all have to live. And even then, it's pretty impossible. But the if you... it's much safer in your work not to have feelings. People are very afraid of them now.
Well, I can't work if I don't... feel something. I mean, it's
well, of course,
total
it shows.
Failure.
It shows in your work, while you and it also shows that this thing is a very well. It certainly is a kind of redemption of everything. I don't think anything I ever saw of yours, I would certainly never call it sentimental.
Well, I was just trying to understand.
And if it's sentimental, if your things are sentimental, why sentimentality is all right, as far as I'm concerned. I can't express my feelings about anything. My whole response to any kind of work of art or any excitement over it is that it's expressed something that I could never express myself. Often it has caused me to feel something that I could never have felt. Without that, I mean, this was true in reading Proust, which was certainly the greatest aesthetic experience I ever had. But and everything else seems to be related to that. But any work of expression is one that expresses something that I wanted to express myself. I'm very glad that I have no talents and can do nothing, because I think we need more to appreciate things than to imitate them. I think that's a great fault in many young photographers is they're interested in somebody else's work, if they're ever interested in it at all, as an idea to get ideas from it. And yet they're the first ones who always describe any kind of influence when they can detect it in anyone. Influences are not bad so long as they're not imitations. I mean, it was Baudelaire, of course, who said that, you know, his whole passion was a passion for pictures. And he meant by that pictures and words and the image. And, of course, the first realization I had of a photograph, what the photograph was as a photograph, was in that book of Walker Evans that was published at the Museum of Modern Art in 1939. And this was at a time when we were all very pro-American. And it was the time when you would think that the whole country would have gone into complete anarchy. Because everybody was very poor. To have a job paying $75 a month was really something. And I saw this book in an exhibition which came to the Art Institute of the 50 Best Design Books of the Year, I think it was called. They had it every year at different places. And I saw this book in a glass case. It said American Walker Evans, American Photographs. And I thought this was a collection of American photographs of, well, Civil War, Reconstruction, whatever. And I ordered that book without knowing what it was. And when it came, it was this book of photographs by one person of America as we saw it then. And of course now people like to think these things were terrible indictments of a society and way of living, but of course we were trying to accept those things. And that book had a great effect on me. And Walker Evans, there was a boy who was a student at the Art Institute named Jack Kinzer from Oklahoma, who was certainly what you think would think of as an American of the 1930s. And we had started going around taking photographs. I mean, the literature then, Sherwood Anderson and Thomas Wolfe and everything incited you to this appreciation of America or looking at it. And we went around taking pictures, and when it came about later, when I finally met Walker Evans, which I never really wanted to meet any arrived artist that I admired very much. I mean, so many people want to meet everybody, but what do you have to say to such a person who has said something to you that you never could have done? And but it was through friends of mine from back in Tennessee who knew him why I did come to know him. He was in town here at one time, and he called me up at the museum. And the next day, I was to meet him and have lunch, and I did, and I was very, I couldn't possibly imagine what this man who had created such a personal, such an individual picture of things, I couldn't possibly imagine what he would be like. So I really expected nothing in the person, which is always best. Of course, then I found this thoroughly American individual, which I think he has remained. But one who had a sensitivity to all sorts of things, I mean, outside of America. And it happened that I had some of these pictures with me, which had just come back from a drugstore somewhere that we had taken in Kentucky. And this friend of mine from Oklahoma. And I showed, he said, "What kind of place is Paducah?" I remember when I first knew Duke Ellington, he had made a record on Brunswick under the name of the Jungle Band called Paducah. I always wondered what it had to do with the town I was in. And Ellington said that he thought it was some kind of an Indian or an Aztec name. Well, it was supposed to be Indian, but it was a spurious Indian name at that. And Walker Evans said, "What kind of place is Paducah?" And I said, "Well, I wish you could see it." Because I said, "Your pictures certainly have somehow immortalized it." And I said, "I have some pictures here." I certainly wasn't trying to get an exhibition or get into Fortune magazine or anything. And he looked at two and he gave them back and he said, "It makes me so damn mad to see anything that anybody else has done that I should have done." And so that was the end of that. He was sent there by Fortune magazine about a year and a half later, and they did a big article on that town, which was published in Fortune with his pictures. He was laid up in the hotel with a sprained ankle, and which is not mentioned, strange to say, in the excellent bibliography in the Museum of Modern Art book that came out, you know, at the time of his last exhibition. They mention every one of his Fortune magazine contributions but that. And it was very curious because Miss Frances Hamill here, who is a book dealer in the city, her niece went down with the Fortune magazine crew to do part of the journalistic job about the town. But he really didn't get to see it very much, but he did everything else. Well, then I suppose, well, of course you saw photographs and photographs. We got all the avant-garde magazines every week. We read them, usually we were looking for the literature in them. And I must say that Walker Evans, when that book came out, it was appreciated by people who were interested, who were fond of America, or who were trying to find themselves in America in a way, and they were not photographers. It was very true of the Robert Frank book later, which was the third great affair in my life. And that I discovered by accident too. It was the French edition of it in a bookstore in Greenwich Village. I bought the book and took it home largely for, I think, the very first superficial approach to it was the French text that was with it, because there were a lot of quotations from writers, ever since, the 18th century on down, French writers writing about America. And when I saw these pictures, I wondered, I stayed up all night in the hotel reading it, and I wondered who in the world this person was, Robert Frank. And the next time I went to the Museum of Modern Art, I mentioned it to Miss Mayer, and she said, "Oh, what? Good heavens, he's right here." I was trying to find out where. I was going to write to the publisher. I wondered if there was any way we could have an exhibition of those things in because they were the, certainly, to me, they meant another discovery of America. To other people, they mean many, many things, which is one reason for their greatness, I think. It's just like in this new book of his, those pictures are entirely transformed by the juxtaposition with different things. They become entirely different pictures. And that's one of the mysteries of photography, I think, is can't do that to paintings. And after that, of course, after we started exhibitions again at the Art Institute after Mr. Pollock had left, and in 1959 when we started again, why, my life became a whole obsession and enthusiasm about photographs, and I was amazed to find how many. Of course, to me, the whole idea of trying to make a presentation of photography is almost a hopeless task, because there are all kinds of photography that should be appreciated. That's the trouble with the educated minority, or the ones who are trying to create a minority in photography, I think, is they want to make it something exclusive and restricted so that one can have a kind of grasp of it. And that's why I want to have shows like the one of Robert Rieger, of the professional football photographs, of all kinds of things that were shown there, so that people all thought that I didn't have any taste. And taste is a very dangerous thing to have. It'll cut down your life terribly.
What years did you work there? I mean, what was the year you began there?
In the print department?
At the Art Institute at all.
Oh, well, I didn't go, I went, I must have started about 1927 or something like that. I worked there on Sundays, just part-time. I was a music student. And then I met Miss Helen.
1927. It sure seems like a long time ago.
Doesn't
it? If you'll pardon, I know, but it...
You better watch out. You may violate the etiquette of old age or something. I was a music student. I really had no talent, and then of course soon the Depression came, and my father had come up here, and he got very sick, and my parents both had to go back, and that for the first time left me alone in my life, because until I was 11 years old, I couldn't even get dressed. They had to. And I had a great deal of pain and everything until I was about 13 years old. And then it seemed I never took any interest in people until I got into high school. Then everybody seemed to pay attention to me then and so forth. And I
what was that, polio? It wasn't polio.
Oh, it was a bone infection, unless you call it. At that time, they called it white swelling, and then later they said it was a tubercular, which it probably was, thing. And I'd had it since I was 8 months old.
And but it stopped when you were then 13? I mean,
the pain stopped when I was about 6 years old. They took me to St. Louis to a surgeon because they realized that something would have to be done so I could go to school or something. And I was so frightened of people. When we came back from St. Louis, he really did nothing. He put it in a brace. But they had to roll me around in a cart until I was about six. And this was a terrible... I don't know how my family stood it, because my father was working on the boats and they were not really unionized at that time. I mean, the salaries were so little, and he was very critical of everything and everybody. And but we got along very well. And I should have started and told all about my family at the beginning and that kind of
thing. I wanted to
maybe some
hear, but you went very quickly over.
Maybe some.
Actually, at first I thought I was going to spend a week here and make 100 tapes, and then...
What were you going to do with them?
Well, I don't know what. I mean, what do you do with those things?
Because I don't want any kind of memory of myself anywhere. Well, in fact, I always thought when you got to this age that you spent all your time in remembering. But I don't care anything about remembering anything now. And as they say that all happy memories are sad, why? That isn't why. It's like something alive, you know. The changes in temperature make it here. It's
that
always
photograph or that chair.
It's that chair. No photograph would ever do that.
You think? I studied history at Chicago. That was
I have
major.
A perfect era of somebody in New York that Rudy Genu told me was going to publish my letters or something. I tell you, this nearly drove me to suicide. This kind of a thing is a terrible thing to...
Who was it? Just the letters they had received?
No, they were going, I guess, to make a systematic canvassing or something. So Martin Suppose, you never heard of him, did you?
It would have been kinder to kill you first, wouldn't it?
Listen, you can never get killed if people are going to do things like that. And then he has a certain viewpoint about me. He's made up a complete fiction about what I am, what I am when people don't see me, and all this sort of thing. It's frightening. This is more common now than ever before. I'm afraid to write a letter to anybody anymore. It's no good because they're all the ones that have written in the past. I don't know.
God knows what he's
saying. Trollope said this is one of the most awful practices, is saving letters. People saving letters. Mm. And still...
It is awful, you think so?
It isn't awful for the other ones who read them, but I think it's rather awful to the one who wrote. And yet I like to read all these letters. Think of all the letters the French people wrote. They love to publish volumes of correspondence and read them and all this. And, of course, letter writing has almost disappeared.
God, I spend so much at the post office mailing letters.
Well, I wish I did.
But that's because where we live.
I wish I did, but the post office is so hard to get to here. Yeah. Now, at last, lately they've opened one down here at 53rd.
Well, I used to think I was some kind of a historian because I took pictures, you know. Like I was a contemporary historian, you know. I had studied history and learned all the stuff about, you know, the ancient historians and who, somebody who traveled around with Alexander, you know, or something. But you talked about the past, you know, and don't you think that some of people who, it seemed like, sometimes I thought, well, maybe I love the past. It's like you make everything into the past when you make photographs or something, you know.
Of course. That's what I said, that thing from Schopenhauer, that there is no reality but the present instant, and we can't realize ever what it is until it becomes past. Schopenhauer never
married. You want to hear a little bit of this? Just to hear the voice?
Oh, I hate to hear my
voice. On this machine, it'll be awful. Better not.
Probably magnifying. Well, we'll see. Let's wait.
That was Danny Lyon's interview with Hugh Edwards from 1972 that they conducted in Chicago at Edwards' apartment. It was an honor and such a pleasure working on this interview, and I want to thank Danny Lyon for entrusting us with this recording that's been so important to him. You can read Danny's piece on Edwards on our website at magichourpodcast.org. You can also visit Danny's blog, bleakbeauty.com, to see some of Edwards' own photographs and some more of Lyon's writing on him. The Art Institute of Chicago also has a great dedicated page to him, where many of his letters are published along with documentation and ephemera from his exhibitions. This episode was produced by me, Jordan Weitzman, and was edited by Crystal Duhame. Hope you enjoyed the show, and thanks for listening.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.